It's time for security now. Steve Gibson calls this episode a propeller head episode. Get your thinking cap and your beanie on because we're going to talk about how something called elliptic curve crypto works and why you might start seeing it on many devices. That's next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 374, recorded October 17th, 2012. Elliptic Curve Cryptography. It's time for Security Now, the show that protects you now. With this guy right here now, the Security Now host and explainer in chief, Mr. Steve Gibson. Hi, Steve.
Too much coffee.
Now! Triple tall latte. So I decided you drink the big cups, right? The venti, quinti, and you put a lot of shots in it. But I realize I don't want all that milk, so I just put a lot of shots in a small cup.
It was so funny. Yesterday, Starbucks, my Starbucks, was demoing their new machine, which just came out.
The Clover. Did you get your Clover?
No. It's a little, consumer
pod-based
thing. The Verazzo something like that. It's, trying to sound Verasic or something. I don't know. Anyway, and so they were like, I was walking around and they said, would you like to try a latte from our new Verazzo? And I said, oh, okay. And they said, but it's not six shots. I was like, oh, okay. Well, maybe we use three of them lined up or something. It was a little disturbing. They have a little pod. It's a pod. We've seen pods before.
I'm not impressed.
Pod of espresso.
Yeah.
They had a pod of milk. And I was looking at it thinking, hey, wait a minute. How did a latte come out of this little pod of milk? Then it got my curiosity up. I did some research. And it's powdered, finely powdered milk. I don't think so.
No.
And it's $200 for this little pod-based system. And, it's what they're pushing now. They have a bigger brother that's got three times the tank size. Then it tells you when the water's getting low or the used pod storage tank is getting full and so forth. But
I am extremely happy with my Breville dual boiler. I have to say, I am getting the best coffee out of that and the Barazza Vario grinder. I mean, I spent a lot more than $200 on it, but I am
it's the best
coffee. And now when I drink Starbucks or even Pete's, it's like, wow, I miss my coffee.
Yep. That's the way to be.
It's nice when you can get some really good espresso out of your own home machine. But that's not what we're here for today.
No, indeed, it is not.
What are we here for? I see something that worries me.
Yeah, it's good.
Elliptical curve cryptography? You're kidding me, right?
We've been doing a bunch of softball episodes for a while. I mean, they've been interesting, but they haven't been very challenging.
Steve's going to throw the high heat today, kids.
So, yes, we need to wind up our propeller beanies springs right to the breaking point in order to get enough lift for this. This is something important that we've referred to from time to time. We have never done explainer-in-chief mode. How does this work? And that is elliptic curve cryptography, ECC. Now, we have an acronym collision, of course. Because ECC is near and dear to my heart as error correction code that I've been living with, ever since the beginning of SpinRite. This is a different ECC. This is an alternative technology for public key crypto as opposed to private key or symmetric crypto, which we've talked about extensively. We also talked about the typical RSA-style crypto, the famous you take two prime numbers and you multiply them in a modulus field, in a finite field, and the point being that it is, we're relying on the difficulty, as far as we know, of factoring large numbers into primes, and it is the difficulty of determining prime factors. We're relying on that hard problem for all of the protection that we get from existing sort of standard RSA-style public key crypto. And the problem with that type of crypto are several that we've talked about. One is primarily it's slow, which is to say it takes a huge amount of work for a processor to perform the operations needed, because the actual protection is relatively weak. That's why we need like 2048-bit keys in order to get state-of-the-art protection. So the protection level is weak, so we compensate for that by making the keys long. Elliptic curve cryptography it's been around already for a couple decades. It's not like it's a brand new invention, but it's coming into vogue because we're becoming more interested in performance and in lower power applications. There are some things coming up I can't talk about that I needed to lay some groundwork for, and we need to understand.
What do you mean you can't talk about it?
Well, I'm there's some things. No, not my stuff. It's other people's work, some products that are in the works that will be using elliptic curve cryptography. And that's a good thing. So I thought, we referred to it. We've never plowed in. And, oh, boy, fire up your coffee pot, Leo.
Is this going to involve math?
Oh, this is going to, okay. The math is so hairy that I'm going to describe it visually and kind of clearly. The point is not to turn us all into cryptographers who could go home and start writing code. The goal is to get an understanding of it, sort of, coffee table style understanding, where in the same way where I can say we take two big primes and we multiply them, now it's hard to take them apart. There's a one-way function there. ECC has something, and that's known as a trapdoor function in cryptography. Elliptic curve cryptography has that too, but it is not as easy to describe. But the flip side of that is we get much more strength. We get something, for example, with 256 bits of that is a public key of just 256 bits. We get the equivalent of about 3,000 bits of prime factor crypto. That is the standard RSA crypto. So much smaller keys, much faster operation. That means smaller packets and easier use. There's implementations for 8-bit chips, 8-bit micros. So there are things that it can do that the sort of the traditional public key crypto can't. But it does it because it's a lot more involved. So that's
and that's where we come in.
And I think I can explain it.
Before we go to the heavy math, it's not going to be that. If you listen to the show, you're smart. We know that. You wouldn't listen to the show if you weren't. You'll be able to figure this all out. But meanwhile, what's going on in computer technology news or security news?
So not too much. We had a big patch from Oracle, our friendly providers of Java, the language many people love to hate to love, have no choice but to love. And many people write to me saying, Steve, I know it's a bad thing. I understand how dangerous it is, but we got to have it. So for those of you who got to have it, Oracle just fixed 30 security holes in their various Java packages. They are now at, if you have moved to major version 7, they are now at update 9. If you are still at major version 6, they are now at update 37. Now, Apple is independently updating Java, but after the catastrophe they had earlier this year with hundreds of thousands of Macs being compromised as a consequence of a known hole that they were slow to patch, they will likely, I think we will probably be having an update from Apple's Java shortly. Nothing so far. This was just yesterday, so what's that, October 16th, that they released this major 30 security hole update. So You can go to java.com, check your version if you need it. The advice is never probably going to change, which is if you know you don't need it, remove it if you have it. If you're not sure if you need it, then you probably don't, so remove it. And only if you know you need it should you keep it, in which case you definitely want to keep it up to date. It is the most routinely exploited entry point for malware. It's just, you know, there are, it's getting less attention because it's not the browser itself. It's, you know, it's right up there with Flash in terms of being an exploit target for hackers. So, you know, both of those things being add-ons to, you know, large add-on libraries to the underlying browser technology. So it's important to keep it updated. And I have not seen, I'm a little bit behind, and I'm waiting because I like to sort of see when this thing's going to update. And, you know, I have it disconnected from my browser, so I'm not in danger. And I've got NoScript locked, you know, locking down my browsing. And I generally don't go anywhere on the internet that's sketchy. So, you know, I'm like you, Leo, I'm generally keeping myself pretty safe. But it is a way for bad guys to get in, so time to fix it.
Yeah.
We talked, was it last week? I think it was just last week, maybe the week before, about the UPEC fingerprint software disaster.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the good news is they were relatively quick in addressing the problem. They're doing a little bit of finger pointing, but I found a blog posting.
Wait a minute. Our software is totally broken, but it's not our fault? Yeah. Well, who can they point a finger at?
Yeah, well, okay, so here's what they said. This is Miroslav Buran. He wrote, "Authentech takes security seriously, which is why we contacted Elcomsoft shortly after their recent blog post, which claimed that Protector Suite stores Windows passwords insecurely." Now, let's remember that with just that information, that claim, what we shared last week was an independent researcher who also cracked it. So it wasn't apparently that difficult. Anyway, they going on with the blog posting, "Authentech evaluated Elcomsoft's claims after they provided relevant information to the company. Based on the findings of our team, Elcomsoft confirmed passwords stored in Protector Suite were not, quote, barely obfuscated, unquote, as written in their report." Okay, so Authentech is saying it wasn't as bad as they said. Okay. Elcomsoft has reverse engineered the AES key generation algorithm in Protector Suite and written code that uses this information to unlock the AES encrypted storage. Now, okay, wait again. We know that this wasn't, you know, they're saying AES like it's some badge of honor. We know that it was dramatically watered down AES 56, mm-hmm. which doesn't really exist in the world. Mm-hmm. They just zero padded it in order to weaken it, apparently, so that it would meet 56-bit maximum key length export requirements. So it's like, okay, well, so yes, all this is true, but it's not like what Authentech had was AES in any standard strength. And then their final, you know, butt covering is any tool that uses this code maliciously must be downloaded by a user and given administrator rights to be effective.
So well, there.
Of course, that's true for everything. Making it no more or less potent than widely available keyloggers in harvesting personal information. And that's not true. Because the login process is specifically protected from eavesdropping with all of that extra stuff that Microsoft does that, for example, keeps – there's no keylogger running at the time that you're logging in, and it is very well protected. and what a reverse engineering of Authentech's insecure technology yields is information at rest access. And being able to access information at rest is vastly more effective than having to try to get something going by. So it's really not comparable. Anyway, they said, finally, in order to protect Protector Suite users, okay, now I guess they're saying they need protection, even though what they've said before was, well, it's not really that big a problem. In the event that Elcomsoft makes this code more widely available, okay, which is not the concern anyone really has, because Elcomsoft isn't likely to do that. They don't need to. Other people have independently broke it. They said, Authentech has created an update to Protector Suite with a hardened version of our AES key generation algorithm. We don't know what that means. You can download the update from the link below. support.authentech.com/PS as in Protector Suite update 2012. So that's all run together, one line. support.authentech.com/PS update 2012. Now, I have been unable to get to the support.authentech.com site all morning. Fortunately, I already had this text grabbed and saved, or I couldn't have grabbed it for the podcast. So I don't know what their problem is, but maybe they're, you know, under attack. Who knows?
Or their servers.
Yeah. And they said, latest version of Protector Suite 2012 included the hardened AES encryption can be found in the download section of the support site. And support.authentech.com/downloads/windows/protector-suite.aspx. Users of Protector Suite with the store-to-device option available and enabled would not be affected, as keys are stored on the fingerprint sensor and are unique to each PC. So what that says is, we wish that everybody was storing their keys in the sensor, but apparently store-to-device option is not always available or enabled, and in which case we store them insecurely in the registry. So this is an unsatisfying response from a security company. They, as we know, the proper response is tell us everything about what you're doing. If you cannot tell us everything about what you're doing, then we have no reason to believe that it is secure or that even you think it is secure, so they're still hiding what they're doing. Still, whatever they've done presumably is better than what they were doing before. So if you are a laptop user, if you are using UPEX fingerprint software, and UPEX has been purchased, as we know, by Authentech, then I would certainly suggest updating to having the 2012 update running. So there is something now for people to do. Still is not very satisfying for a company that is attempting to provide, you know, very, you know, mission critical security technology.
I just don't know. It sounds like it's like a non-denial denial. I just,
yeah,
like, come on.
Yeah.
Take
this
responsibility.
This is not the right way to handle this at all. You know, blaming the people who found a vulnerability and then accusing them of maybe releasing it in the future, so that's why you're going to increase your security instead of just fixing it.
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't sure we were going to have a podcast today, Leo.
You said that, and I'm puzzled because you are the man. You've never missed one. What could possibly make you want to miss a show?
Came very close.
I got to know. What is this magic thing?
One of my favorite authors, one of this podcast's favorite authors, Michael McCollum.
Ah, sci-fi. Go ahead.
Sci-fi-az.com.
Right.
His webpage right now, if you go there, maybe you should go there before anybody else does, Leo, if you want to show
them. Hold on. Everybody stop right now. We have a habit of bringing stuff down. Okay, got it.
sci-fi-az.com. Yep. You'll see a picture there.
Euclid's Wall. Michael, what is
Euclid's
that?
Euclid's Wall. Yeah. Well, Michael sent me his manuscript when he was the only person who had read it. I have since been in communication with him.
Write it down.
And he and his wife are reading it.
What? Just killed it.
Okay.
I'm glad I pulled it up before you did. Dead.
I couldn't put it down.
Really?
It is really fun. There are so many fun things about it. First of all, I was a little worried because it had a three-masted sailing, you know, I don't know what you call it, a galleon, Nina the Pinta the Santa Maria style.
Yeah.
You know, big...
Ahoy, matey.
Big ship right on the front cover.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, okay, you know, I don't know. You know, what is this going to be? And in the first, in the prologue, two PhDs basically destroy the world.
That's not good.
Now, I would never give away anything important, so that is not an important thing to know. Because you learn it in the first two pages.
Oh, okay.
That sets us up for a really interesting sort of adventure story set further in the future. This is 2030 or 2087. Two PhDs think they have discovered an infinite source of energy.
Oh, no, not the old black hole infinite source of energy problem.
Exactly. And it doesn't turn out quite the way they...
Oh, dear. Sucks the whole darn earth right in there.
Well, no, but I won't talk about what it does. But
not good, obviously.
Suffice to say, it shakes us back to almost no civilization.
Oh.
We then pick up the story 100 years hence.
Oh.
Where there are things like techno-archaeologists.
Right. Digging this, figure out, how did they make these things?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And little really intriguing bits of stuff that have survived, and anyway, I don't want to say any more. I don't know how soon Michael is going to have it available. He publishes, I don't know if he'll publish in print as he has his other novels or ebooks, which he has both on his site and on Amazon through, you know, Amazon's Kindle.
I like this genre. Did you ever read a book called Earth Abides?
No.
A guy goes up on a hike into a mountain, and when he comes back, everybody's dead. Some disease hit. He got a little bit, but he survived. Kind of like The Stand, where a disease wipes out civilization. Yeah. I love that kind of story.
Well, this has got romance and good character development.
That's great.
Michael always sets up really intriguing problems, which is why he wrote the Gibraltar Earth series. Just everything he's done, I have enjoyed. And anyway, so the point is, I just couldn't stop reading it.
You couldn't put it down.
I could not stop reading it.
Wow.
And I finished it last night, fortunately, and so we have a podcast today. Otherwise, I don't know.
Is it a long book?
No. I got it from him middle of last week, and I had a lot of things going on with me, and I apologize for not having been able to get to it. And so mostly I read it over the weekend and yesterday and really enjoyed it. So I can't recommend it yet because... Can't buy it yet. But, you know, he said coming next month. I don't know.
That's what his webpage says right now.
So it will be soon. So we're not teasing people too much. But anyway, it was very fun.
And
his other ones, for example, have been trilogies. This one wraps it. This is not. I would have a different position if I was left with a cliffhanger, because as we know, it's so annoying to like read something and then it's like, God, now I got to wait for.
Hate it when that happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. I can't wait. That's exciting. I'm gonna have to go
now,
get a copy.
Many people have asked for a third part of our Over the Sugar Hill series, Leo.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think we should do, but I wanted to formally make a call for our listeners' experiences. It's been more than 6 months for me. It's been more than 6 months for everyone. So there is a feedback page on the health-related research pages at GRC, grc.com/health/lowcarb.htm, or actually /health/feedback.htm. I would like to have, I don't want to just relate my own history and yours. I would love to have our listeners give us a larger sampling of their experiences. Either way, good, bad, tried it, fell off of it, tried it, loved it, and so forth. So I wanted to formally make a call for people to send me their experiences. Let me know if I can use their name or not. I'm happy to keep it anonymous if they'd rather that. It's a little more fun if we have a name attached, but I certainly understand if somebody...
They're afraid Dr. Mom will find out. And
so
they don't want that to happen.
And so we will come back to the topic and have a lot of, you know, a much broader base of experience to share.
Good. Can't wait.
I got an interesting question from... I'm not sure he's a listener, actually, because it just sort of it didn't specifically say, but he asked... a question about SpinRite that I thought our listeners would find interesting. His name is Alan Levine, and he said, we work in the VDI, the Virtual Desktop Infrastructure and SAN space. Can you let me know how many read-writes your level 4 SpinRite product does in an hour on a 500-gigabyte disk, and if different, on an SSD? I know that you all, oh, he is a listener, because otherwise he wouldn't know that I only recommend levels 1 or 2 on SSDs, which, of course, we've been discussing recently, so Alan is probably listening to this. But some expensive ones are claimed to have a very long life in spite of whatever you throw at them. I'd like to find out if that's true. Okay, so I wrote back, I said, SpinRite's surface analysis / pattern testing strategy has evolved significantly since the early days of MFM and RLL drives. When drives switched to PRML encoding, which is what they use now, that stands for Partial Response Maximal Likelihood, which gives you a sense for how far out in the voodoo weeds...
I don't want to hear likelihood when it comes to my hard drive.
Exactly.
It might be day-to-day.
Partial response maximal likelihood. It's the bits are truly so close together that they are now interacting with each other. So the drive looks at what it gets back when it's reading and chooses the highest likelihood of what was written that would result in that being read back. I mean, that's how far out we have gone. I mean, it really has become amazing that these things work at all. Anyway, so what's happened is there are several stages of processing between what I would call the user data, that is the data we think we're storing on the drives, and what actually is written. There was, for example, back in the early days, you will remember, Leo, there was something called write precompensation. And
yeah.
And what happened was at a certain cylinder of the drive, write precomp would be engaged. And what that meant was, think about it, as you go to successively inner cylinders that have a shorter circumference, but you're storing the same number of bits on each cylinder, that is, on each track. If the track is further in, it's got an actual lower circumference. It's a shorter track in terms of its linear measurement, which means the bits are pushed closer together. Well, it turns out that when you read back bits of differing polarity, which are close together, they read back as closer than they actually are. That is, they appear closer than they were written because they are influencing each other. So right pre-compensation, it pre-compensated for that, essentially, that sort of a, that bit attraction by writing them further apart on purpose so that when they read back, they would be in the position that they were to be expected. So this gives you, you know, that's the old days. But so that's an example of some algorithmic fudging that was being done in order to allow more bits to be stored. Well, we're now decades past that, where, you know, maximal likelihood is the domain we're in. The point is that SpinWrite once knew how to write patterns that were so-called worst-case patterns. Those were patterns which deliberately used the knowledge of what was difficult to read in order to make it harder for the drive to do its job. Thus, those were patterns that SpinWrite used for testing the surface and testing the whole reading-writing channel. Well, there's no way to know today what we tell the drive to write and what it actually does write, because there's several stages, about three or four stages of pre-processing that go on to, like, there's a process called whitening, where no matter what we write, we end up with a 50-50 statistical probability of bits, and all kinds of pre-writing and coding in order to put down flux reversal patterns that again have the maximal likelihood of being read back. So this notion of pattern testing has really gone away. Consequently, what SpinWrite does is something that is simple and fast, because the other thing that's happened, of course, is drives have gotten huge, so you just can't afford the time of doing 30 different test patterns on a drive. So SpinWrite reads the data, inverts all the ones to zeros and zeros to ones, writes that back, then reads that and verifies that it got back the inverted data. Then it reinverts it, or that is to say, rewrites the original data, and then rereads it to make sure that it could read that back. So it says, okay, there's no way to know what's actually being put on the drive. We're going to verify that at the data level, we can write ones and zeros to every location in terms of the user's data, and we will use the tremendous capability of the drive to recover whatever it's got back to our data, and use that. If there's a problem, the drive will see it, and then we'll relocate that data to safety, as we've described in the past. So, consequently, SpinWrite writes exactly twice the size of the drive while it's running, if you're running in the level 4 pattern testing mode, where it's actually writing to the surface, even if it was able to read it without any trouble. So SpinWrite reads the surface, recovers the data, then does its dual inversion, flipping all the bits from zeros to ones and ones to zeros but twice, and verifying that the drive is able to read that back in each case, which again shows the drive if it's going to have a problem with that area in the future. So if you had a 2 terabyte drive, SpinWrite would write 4 terabytes of data. In the case of Alan's question, a 500 gig disk, it would write 1 terabyte worth of data, essentially writing every sector on the drive twice. So that's the answer to the question, and another little bit of peeking under the covers of how SpinWrite works.
This is good. You put this all together, you have a pretty good idea.
Yeah,
pretty impressive. A lot of energy. Obviously.
Lots of technology under the cover.
All right, beanies on.
Okay, so we've talked many times about symmetric cryptography, where you have key lengths of 128 bits, 192, 256, AES, the our current symmetric encryption standard is that. It's very fast. It's used for so-called bulk data encryption. It's, you know, and things like RC4 is another example of in that case, a stream cipher, which is used for performing bulk encryption. So we have those which use private keys or secret keys, which are able to encrypt and decrypt at high speed. We also famously have public key cryptography, the sort of the flip side, where we, instead of using one key, which is used typically with either one or two algorithms, you may have, for example, in the case of RC4, it produces a bit stream, which we exclusive OR with the data in order to encrypt it, which means we do the same thing to decrypt it. We produce the same bit stream over at the decryption end and exclusive OR it again, which turns all the bits back into what they originally were. There's an example of one algorithm that does that is used to do both encryption and decryption, or typical iterative crypto like AES. We did a podcast on exactly how AES works, where you take the key, you run it through a so-called key expansion in order to create lots more bits than the key has, and then you successively run your decrypted data through an iterative process that uses chunks of the derived key bits each time, and you run it through, like, you know, 11 or 14 or however many times the cryptographers determine is necessary to sufficiently scramble the data. And every time through that iteration, it takes a unique input combination and produces and maps it essentially to a very difficult to track output combination, yet in a single iteration doesn't do it enough that you couldn't figure it out. Thus they run it through enough times that the relationship between bits is lost from what you initially put in and what you initially get out. But that means that decrypting it, you can't do the same thing. You have to literally reverse the process. So with a cipher like AES, that is to say Rheindahl, you decrypt with a different approach. You run it sort of backwards in order to get back what you put in. So then we have so that's the whole symmetric side. Relatively fast, a secret key. You use the same key, but either the same or different algorithms, depending upon the way the cipher works. With public key cryptography, we have a whole different model, and elegant in its own right, where we have typically a private key and a public key, and it doesn't have to be, the other key doesn't have to be public, but the idea being that one key is used for encrypting or enciphering to produce something unpredictable, given an input and you get an output, and only the matching key, the key that was made, typically these are made as a pair, one is kept private, the other is made public, but again, only the other key can be used to undo what the first key does. So that was a huge breakthrough for crypto, because until that time, there was the whole problem of, well, how do I, if I have a secret key cipher, like we've talked about first, like AES, how do you get that to the recipient securely to allow them to decrypt what you've encrypted? So there's a whole communication problem. You need some sort of a secure channel to get the secret information. With public key cryptography, that problem is solved, because you can just pick a big random number and you can encrypt it with your recipient's public key and then send it publicly, because only somebody who has the matching private key, and presumably the recipient would be keeping it secret, is able to decrypt what you encrypted with their public key. So this is the foundation of all of our modern crypto that we've talked about. And the idea is the public key technology, cryptography, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, it works, but it works in a fundamentally different way, where we rely on some sort of a difficult problem, but it's sort of a softer domain. That is to say, for example, with traditional public key crypto, like, you know, RSA style, where we rely on the difficulty in factoring the products of large primes. Well, it's the largeness of the primes that creates the problem. If these were small primes, then their product would be small, and computers are so fast these days that it wouldn't be that difficult. We have spent a lot of energy on coming up with ways to factor to produce prime factorizations of numbers. So it's not that is difficult so much as it is time consuming, and we've never, despite all the time and attention we've given to it, we've never found a way to short circuit essentially what is brute force. So the strength we get from traditional prime factorization style public key cryptography arises from the size of the factors, the size of the numbers. But the flip side of that is the keys must be big. So, I mean, everything must be big numbers. And so what that means is when we're dealing with big numbers, then processors still have word sizes much smaller than those big numbers. And we're talking about 2048 bits, but the processors are down at 32 or 64 bits typically. So that means they have to do everything in multiple chunks, and they have to handle multiple precision math and, you know, really hairy stuff. So what that means is that cryptography is not applicable for bulk crypto. That's why we use the clever approach of choosing, as I mentioned before, we choose a random number, we encrypt that using the public key technology, send that to someone who can decrypt it. Now we've essentially managed to share a symmetric key, which we can then use for performing our bulk crypto. And that's basically the way SSL and many of these other hybrid protocols function. Now, everything's fine, except that it's difficult to put this kind of very processor-intensive technology on a smart card or on an RFID tag or on a near-field chip. Did I hear you go, Lee?
Yeah, now I'm getting it. Why did we need another one? Well, because this one is computationally intensive.
Exactly.
So we need a way we could do it less expensively.
Exactly. And what would be really cool is if we had a technology that was public key crypto that was lightweight enough that we could use it with near-field technology. That is something like printed on a piece of paper. The weakness, as we discussed when we were talking about near field stuff, is that it's just, you know, it's basically giving you a serial number, like an RFID tag. And now there are better solutions for that, but we're never really talking in terms of serious crypto. For future applications, it would be nice if we had stronger, that is to say, really good public key style crypto for something that could be powered. I mean, it is computationally simple enough that it can be powered off of a pulse of electromagnetic radiation rather than needing, you know, heat sinks and fans to keep it cool while it's doing its work. Well, enter elliptic curve cryptography, ECC. It's an entirely different way of solving this, essentially giving us the same feature. And because it's got nothing to do with prime factorization, it's like starting over. It's like, okay, let's come up with a whole different approach. So, as I also mentioned at the top, it's not my intention to turn us all into people who can go home and write code for ECC at the end of this, but I want to give everyone a sort of a level of comfort, a feeling for kind of what it means, so that it's like, okay, I kind of get that. Sort of at the same level as, okay, I understand if I take two big prime numbers and multiply them together, then it's going to be difficult to take them apart. You know, multiplying is easy, factoring is hard. So what we have with elliptic curve cryptography is a dip into some kind of hairy math, but not impenetrable. We just sort of have to say, okay, I'm going to allow this. So, for example, what is a curve? A parametric curve is what elliptic curve cryptography uses. Now, a simple parametric curve is x equals y. And if we took a two-dimensional, and this is planar, this is all just two-dimensional, so we have just an x and a y axis that are orthogonal on a two-dimensional plane surface. So the parametric curve x equals y is, as we know from our high school algebra, is a straight line, a diagonal line, running at a 45-degree angle, because where if x equals y on our graph, where we have x equals 1, y will be 1. Where x equals 2, y will be 2. Where x equals 3, y will be 3. So, and all values in between, similarly, x and y are the same, which gives us this x equals y equation describes this straight line on our graph. Now, if we added a constant, say y equals x plus 5, well, so now if x equals 1, y equals 6, because we have x plus 5 equals y. So x equals 1, y equals 6, x equals 2, y equals 7. So again, we have a diagonal line, but it's been shifted upwards by 5. So it's the same 45 degree angle shifted up by 5. Now if we were to multiply one of these parameters, say y equals 2x, well, then when x equals 1, y equals 2. When x equals 2, y equals 4. When x equals 3, y equals 6. So what's happened is the slope of the line changed when we added that two parameter to the y equals x. So it's y equals 2x. Now the slope is increased. If instead we said y equals x over 2, which is the same as x times 1/2, then the slope of the line decreases. It's more horizontal. It's flatter. And similarly, we could do both at once. We could say y equals 2x plus 5, which would give us a steeper line, which is also moved up by 5. So we can do both at once. So that's, you know, this is something we all obviously know from high school algebra. Now we can also do something a little different. We could say, for example, y equals x squared, or, you know, x times x. So now we get a different, now suddenly we don't have a straight line anymore. If x is 1, then y equals 1 times 1, which is 1. If x is 0, we ought to start there maybe, then y is 0. When x goes to 2, though, y jumps up to 4, because we have y equals 2 times 2 is 4. When x is 3, y jumps up to 9,
because we have 3 squared. So what we get is a parabola. We get a curve on the positive side of x, which goes up very steeply, and on the negative side of x, it also goes up very steeply, because minus 2, where if x is minus 2, minus 2 times minus 2 is positive 4. So thus we get a parabolic curve. We could then do things to it, like add or take factors and so forth. Okay, so I wanted to give us a little bit of foundation first, just so we're on the same page, because the equation for elliptic curve cryptography, all ECC, is y squared equals x to the third plus ax plus b. That's all there is to it. So y times y squared equals x to the third, that is x times x times x, plus ax, where a is a parameter, plus b, where b is, as we saw before, skews the whole thing. That is the sort of the master equation for elliptic curve cryptography. So what that describes, this y squared equals x to the third plus ax plus b, it's a complex relationship between x and y. Depending upon what the parameters are, it can look very different. The concept then is that we have points on this curve which we multiply by themselves. So think about we have this, if you imagine a two-dimensional surface with some lines drawn on it, and the lines satisfy that equation. That is to say, they're continuous curves, but every point on that curve, if you take the x coordinate and the y coordinate, that equation is satisfied for a chosen A and B parameters. So the act of coming up with turning this from that curve to crypto is, we have, again, I use the term trapdoor. That is, a trapdoor is a one-way function. It's something which we can do easily in the forward direction, but we cannot do it easily in the reverse direction. In the case of prime numbers, the trapdoor is, it's easy to multiply two primes. It is difficult, if you don't know what they are, if you only have the product, to pull them apart again. So that's the trapdoor function upon which traditional RSA resides. In the case of elliptic curve cryptography, we have a curve with known parameters. That is, when these algorithms are published, or when the implementation of this is published, the parameters A and B are public. They're known, and they're the subject of standards. NIST has a bunch of ECC curves where they've worked out the details, and the A and B parameters are part of what is described as, you know, given this curve, then this is the one that we will use to perform our encryption. So the process of encryption is to take a point on the curve and multiply it by itself. That is, through successive addition, where we take a point on the curve and add it to itself. Well, now that's it's like, okay, wait a minute. It's a point on the curve. How do we add a point to a point? Well, this is defined by the mathematicians as something called point addition, which exists in the field of math for these kinds of curves. Point addition
is defined as taking two points along a curve and computing where a line which passes through them intersects the curve. So you have two different points on the curve, which, and again, this y squared equals x to the third plus ax plus b curve, two points on there. So you those two points, as we know from, again, from high school algebra, two points define a line. So somewhere the curve intersects, somewhere else the curve intersects this line. So the point of the line's intersection that passes through our two points that we're adding, where that line intersects the curve, that's the what's called the sum of the first two points. Well, okay, the problem is how do you start? Because if you're starting with just one point, then you have a whole family, essentially infinite number of lines, because there's no second point different from the first to establish a line. So the mathematician said, that's easy. We will define the straight line where the two points are the same as the tangent line at that point in the curve. So we start with a point, and the curve will have some slope at that point. And so we obtain the tangent line, which is, of course, the line that runs tangent or perpendicular to the, along in, has the same slope as the line, than our elliptic curve line does at that point. And so that defines the line for the first two points, which are not different from each other. That gives us a third point. Now we've got two points, and we can then draw lines between them. So if you're still with me,
I got it. It's a tangent.
Yeah. So we take a point, and we find the tangent of the tangent angle at that point. Then we look at where that line intersects the curve, and that gives us our second point. Now we have that point and our first point, and they form a line, which we find out where that intersects the curve. That gives us our third, and so forth. So this allows us to iteratively sum from a given point some number of times. In elliptic curve crypto, the number of times we do that is the private key. So we take a random number. We take a random number that is are going to be our private key, and we multiply. Essentially, think about it. If we take the point plus the point plus the point plus the point, well, that's n times p, where n is our private key. So we're multiplying the point by our private key. The result of all of that, and you can imagine, how constructive, sort of geometrically constructive this is, because we're dealing with this wacky elliptic curve and plotting points on it, and where lines through the para points intersect the curve, and then we jump to there and continue. We do that however many times is required for the private key that we choose. The result is the public key. And the point is, there is no way, you can well imagine, no way to reverse that process. That is, this is a very difficult one-way process. The trapdoor function is doing all of that from a given private key is the number of times we move along this curve, computing these points, and the result is the public key. And it is possible using this math to essentially what we get is the same sort of thing, a one-way function. We can easily, relatively easily, go forward. There is no known way to go backward. And the reason we've gone through all this is the bit space that all of this operates in is vastly smaller than the bit space required for factoring. Factoring is not difficult enough that we can use small numbers. We have to use huge numbers because we're pretty good at factoring. This wacky system that we've come up with elliptic curves, is understandably, or believably difficult enough that relatively few bits gives us equivalent protection. 160 bits of ECC is the equivalent of 1024 bits of traditional prime factorization, public key technology. Remember that 1024 has been plenty strong for a long time. I only recently, and everybody else moving to extended validation certificates, only recently went to 2048, and that's believed to be strong, forever. So, a long time. Most of the websites on the net are still at 1024 bits of standard RSA encryption, and they're plenty strong. We get that equivalent strength with just 160 bits of within the ECC space.
So why don't we use it for everything?
It's newer. Cryptographers are famously conservative. Look at here.
Yes, they should be. Yes.
Yes, we launched the SHA-3 competition. What is it? 8 years ago, just because maybe SHA-256 wasn't going to be strong enough.
Right.
And it turns out, it is strong enough. We really don't need SHA-3. But cryptographers are super conservative. When I was researching this to get a better sense for where we are, there's a bunch of annual conferences that are held, and there's someone who sort of maintains a state of ECC. And he said, for the fifth year in a row, I'm here to report that really nothing has happened.
So this is how old? 5 years old then?
Oh, no. This is a couple decades old.
Oh, all right. So it's not that new.
Exactly. I was probably more than anything the strength of RSA, just the the political strength of RSA. They had, everyone was enamored of the idea. They got all the press and the attention. RSA's patents expired in 2000. The original designers of this put it into the public domain, but there have been some implementation tricks that were patented. So this isn't, ECC is not as obviously free of intellectual property collision, except that a lot of people are taking the position that it is, in fact, that you can do everything you want to do with ECC today with no intellectual property concern. Dan Bernstein, who is we've spoken of, is a famous cryptographer. He's got a bunch of ECC stuff on his site and free open source. It is now, for example, it's in OpenSSL, it's in the Crypto++ library, it's in the GNU TLS library, it's in OpenSSH, the NSS, the Mozilla security suite has had it in their crypto libraries. Now remember the way SSL operates during that initial handshake. This is one of the nicest things about the way SSL and TLS was designed, is that the client says, here's all of the crypto suite, you know, tools that I know of. And then the server is able to look among them and choose the strongest of those that it also supports. So they automatically handshake and negotiate for the strongest means of establishing their relationship. That means that, for example, when you build an instance of OpenSSL and you enable the ECC cipher suites within the protocol, when you connect to a server that has had the same thing done, you'll automatically negotiate a strong ECC connection. And if both ends support it, you can get by with a much shorter bit string, which allows you to essentially short circuit the long setup time that ECC had, that the traditional SSL has when it's forced to use standard large prime public key technology. So what's happening is this is getting attention because performance is becoming a problem. People have been pounding on ECC now for a while. It's less obviously or it's less intuitively difficult to reverse this process. As of 2009, there is still no proof, actual formal proof of the security of elliptic key crypto, which, you know, isn't a bad thing. It's just a hard problem. Hmm. Similarly, there's no proof that we can't factor large numbers into their primes. We just have, no one has ever figured out how. I mean, they've gotten better at it, but they're, you know, still, if they're big, we cannot figure out a way to do it. We've never been able to prove we can't, but it seems unlikely, and we're resting our entire foundation on the fact that we can't. So the cryptographers are actually more comfortable with elliptic curve crypto than they are with prime factorization crypto. That is to say, the people that have been looking at this now, they feel better about the strength of elliptic curve crypto in the future than they do about the future strength of crypto relying on prime factorization. The sense is everybody's a little uncomfortable about, you know, how strong that actually is. And the other thing is that as people have been working on both, the sense is that the prime factorization problem has been softening at a faster pace than the elliptic curve crypto problem has been. So the elliptic curve, the people working on it feel, you know, it's harder. It's a harder problem. It's less likely to fall to some breakthrough than factorization is. And everybody likes the fact that you can, with 160 bits, you can get the equivalent strength of 1024-bit prime factorization-style public key technology. And so what I think we're going to see is at some point in the future, we will be talking about devices which are using elliptic curve crypto, and now we all know what it is.
You're masterful, my friend. I don't understand a word you said, but it is masterful. It's really interesting, and it sounds like in time it might replace traditional public key crypto.
I kind of think it's going to. Again, cryptography and cryptographers are conservative, and we're all glad they are, because when you think about it, you know, there have been mistakes made in the past with the application of these things. You know, even RC4 that was famously troubled in its initial implementation with WEP, the wired equivalent privacy encryption used in the first Wi-Fi protocol. Well, it wasn't RC4's fault. The implementers of the RC4 algorithm did some things like not letting it warm up enough. It generates pseudo-random bit sequences, but you got to let it churn for about 256 cycles in order for it to have scrambled itself up enough. And they didn't. They immediately started using the first things that it emitted, and it turns out that there was that meant that it hadn't scrambled up the key that it was given, and so there was a findable relationship between the key and the pseudo-random sequence that was being used to XOR the data, and it fell as a consequence. So what's nice is that we really don't have any instances of an outright collapse. We have things like MD4, which, okay, no one ever broke it, but we got so much faster with our GPUs and our computers that it no longer was something we felt comfortable relying on. It became soft, and so we moved to MD5, and then that got a little soft. And so now we're at SHA-1, but new things should use SHA-256. So what we're seeing is we're getting better at understanding these problems, the problems that we have deliberately erected for ourselves in order to create privacy. And we're staying, however, well ahead of the, if you'll pardon the pun, the curve.
I suspect just because it's so computationally simple that, and we are doing so many new devices that need crypto built in, that this really will be a great choice.
And the idea of having a lightweight, inexpensive technology which is can be deployed with strong public key style technology, not just private key stuff. For example, all of the dongles that we've been talking about, those are all symmetric key. Yeah. Those have a secret in them, and
that's insecure.
Yes, exactly. There is a secret in them, and we're relying on the fact that they're just giving us the output from that for the security. But we're not. There's no sort of a challenge, we're not giving them a challenge that they have to then answer to prove that they are who they are. They're just, we're maintaining a secret at RSA and a secret in the dongle, and we've already seen what happens if RSA is unable to keep their secrets. So we're going to take a next step here before long, and I wouldn't be surprised if at some point, certainly within the life of this podcast, which seems to show no sign of
infinite,
we'll be talking about some cool stuff that have ECC in them, elliptic key crypto, and now comfortable with the concept because it's going to be secure enough for us.
Very interesting. Really great stuff. ECC, not the ECC you're thinking of, elliptic curve cryptography.
Yes, not error correction code. That's for a different topic.
Steve Gibson knows all about that, too, and he will no doubt. In fact, I think he already has talked about that on a show. We have lots of them, 374 shows in toto, available in two places. One on Steve's site, grc.com, and he does 16 kilobit versions of the show and transcripts of the show. So that's really great if you want a small, compact way to listen. We make video and audio, high-quality audio, available at our site, too, twit.tv/SN for security. Now, when you get to grc.com, though, check out SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. You got to have. If you got a hard drive, you got to have SpinRite. And lots of great freebies, too, which he's always giving away. Next week, we will have a Q&A, I presume, unless major breaking news happens over the next few days. And if that's the case, you can ask your questions at grc.com/feedback. Steve will pick 10 good ones for next week's GRC. Yes. Did I say spin drive? No, spin right.
Yeah.
Spin right.
And I do want to encourage people, if you've had a story that you think would be interesting for us to share with your very low carb experience, I know people were sharing initially. I'd like to know how that's worked out over the course of 6 months, and we will do a third on a Saturday after your text guy.
Yep.
We'll sneak one in and let everyone know that it exists.
Saturday or Sunday. Actually, it might be better Sunday.
Because I thought that collided with Twit.
Twit's got is an hour after the tech guy. So we did it last time. I think we did it on a Sunday.
Oh, yeah. We can easily.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. But we'll let you know ahead of time.
Yep.
And no, Guyver, we're not going to do a very low-carb podcast. I think we'd run out of things to say. Yeah. I think there's a paleo show somewhere, though. Is it a 5x5 or somebody has a paleo show?
Oh, there are several. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Podcasts.
So you could go listen to those. Absolutely.
That's too much.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Go ahead.
Thanks, Leo.
Do you have something else you want to say? I don't want to interrupt.
No, all right. Glad you stopped me.
Go have some lunch. All right, Steve. Thanks a lot. See you later. Secure now.